people think little girls should be seen and not heard, but I think
class war.
Class war, the only war.
We want to just quickly send a nice friendly message to the Fraternal Order of Police in Philadelphia.
This is an anti-Nazi song.
Hey, what's up? Welcome back to another episode of The Rebel Beat, a Firebrand Records podcast and your source for class war on the dance floor, the collision of music and movements for radical social change. My name is Aaron. So happy to have you with us for this episode 95 of the podcast. We're inching our way towards 100 episodes, and that is 100 episodes. You can go back and listen to all of them up on our website, rebelbeatradio.com. Got a bit of a fall cold coming in, so if you hear my voice sounding a little bit nasal, it's because I'm all blocked up and sneezing right now. So the question on the show today is, what do the songs of the African National Congress, the Swedish labor movement, and Chilean Nueva Canción singers have in common? Their music has been gathered into a stunning forthcoming book called The Encyclopedia of Political Record Labels. Radical artist and Just Seeds Collective member Josh McPhee joins us on the program today. He wrote that book, and he's going to tell us all about it when we come back. So don't go anywhere.
It's about the liberation struggle. It's about those children who took to the streets, fighting, screaming free Nelson Mandela. It's about those unions who put down their tools and demanded freedom. Lizobuya, yes, Yebo, yes, yeah, hey. It's about the sweat, the blood that was spilled for all of us to be free so that we can participate in the economy of this country. Even though we still await the greater freedom where all of us should be free and participate in the economy, so we can eradicate poverty in our time. Not just a few families should be rich, but all of us should be liberated. Come to recognize that South Africa is not yet free until all these people are free in the year 2000, liberated economically, when they have land, something that is so important, something to put your feet on. Oh,
Alright, welcome back here on The Rebel Beat. We just heard the tune Lizoboya by Mbojeni Nejema of South Africa. And I wanted to play that anti-apartheid tune because I think it fits in really well with our guest and our theme on today's show, political record labels. But more on that in just a little bit. If you like The Rebel Beat, here are three very simple ways you can support this show. If you haven't already done so, first, make sure you subscribe. You can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spotify. While you're there, wherever you get your podcasts, you can leave us a rating or a review. Really helps other people to find the podcast. Speaking of other people finding the podcast, tell a friend about this podcast. I think that's one of the best ways we can spread the love around podcasts is word of mouth. So just, you know, next time you're kicking it with your crew and everyone's talking about the best podcasts they're listening to, be like, hey, I know this podcast where they talk about radical music and radical social movements. I think it'll make you dance. I think it'll make you think. Check out The Rebel Beat. And lastly, if you can, please do support us with a little bit of pocket change on Patreon. You can find our Patreon page at patreon.com/rebelbeatradio. If you donate there, there's some awesome swag you can get. Listening to this show is free. It's always going to be free. You don't hear ads from annoying mattress companies or those food boxes or anyone trying to sell you anything, but it is not free to produce. So, you know, if you're thinking, I want to hear this show keep going for as long as possible, now is a good time to hit pause. And again, go to patreon.com/rebelbeatradio. You can make a monthly contribution there, or if you want to make a one-time contribution, just hit us up for however much money you want. You can send us a donation at rebel@ckut.ca. That's rebel@ckut.ca. Okay, so on with the show. Our special guest for today is Josh McPhee. Now, I've known Josh for a long time as a committed radical organizer, a gifted artist with the Just Seeds Collective. You can check out their stuff at justseeds.org, and also the author of several books looking at the intersections between activism and art. I've visited him a few times when he's been working shifts at the Interference Archive in Brooklyn, a space that really celebrates the visual culture of our movements all over its walls. If next time you're in Brooklyn, you gotta go check out the Interference Archive. So Josh McPhee has a new book coming out called An Encyclopedia of Political Record Labels. coming out on Common Notions. It's such an incredible work of research, bringing together decades of analog sounds and the labels who distroed them. A lot of this stuff, you can't find it anywhere online. It's not up on Spotify. It's not up on YouTube. Josh really just had to dig through the crates, as we say, you know, just kind of finding all these amazing LPs that have emerged from some of the most exciting social movements over the decades. In a way, Josh looks at the record label like another political propaganda tool, not unlike a printing press or a community radio station. They can be places to propagate ideas just as much as beats and bass. So here's my interview with Josh. The book comes out in October of this year, but you can pre-order it immediately through Common Notions and save a little bit of money on your copy. We'll put a link to order it in the show notes. And Josh will be also on tour around the Northeast of the US this fall to promote the book. You can see all his dates at commonnotions.org. All right, let's get into that interview with Josh McPhee. Joining me on the Rebel Beat today is our special guest, Josh McPhee, who is a graphic designer, an activist, a writer, and also one of the co-founders of the Just Seeds Collective. I'm sure many of our listeners are familiar with their work. You probably have one of the Celebrating People's History posters up on your wall, maybe in one of the corners of your apartment, and also co-founder of the Interference Archive, one of my favorite radical spaces in Brooklyn, New York. Welcome to the program, Josh.
Thanks, and I'm so happy to be here, and thanks for having me.
Yeah, definitely. So what we're going to be talking about today is, you know, very apropos on the Rebel Beat. We're going to be talking about one of your latest projects and an upcoming book of yours called An Encyclopedia of Political Record Labels. It's going to be coming out this fall. A lot of amazing stuff in here. I did get my hands on kind of a like an early PDF of this. I already got to kind of glance through. But yeah, tell us a little bit about this project and how it came to be.
This is a project that I've been working on for pretty much, I mean, 4 years now, in fits and starts. And it all really started 4 or 5 years. It started in 2014 when I was helping a friend of mine, some friends of mine, clean their apartment. And one of them is a woman that some people might be familiar with. Her name is Silvia Federici. Mm-hmm. She's an Italian feminist theorist and activist. And
quite a legend, I was, too.
I was like, they just needed help. They're just kind of buried in stuff, as you can imagine, a life of being a organizer and an activist and an intellectual and a professor, you know, things pile up. And so I was just helping them clean a little bit, and she opens up a closet door and pulls out this little stack of records and hands them to me. And I'm like, oh, what is this stuff? And it was about a dozen 7-inch records that were all produced by different political organizations in Italy as part of their struggles. Wow. And it kind of blew my mind. I had no idea that this existed. And, you know, I grew up in the pretty deeply entrenched in the punk rock scene in this Boston area in the late 80s and early 1990s. And I've been really involved in DIY. But I had, you know, for at least the last decade, if not more, more like 20 years, largely sort of disillusioned by music, particularly its sort of conversion to dematerialized sound that was just endlessly playing out of tinny computer speakers. It just became background noise for me, and I lost all of the kind of desire and lust that I had in relationship to it when I was a kid. And then this sort of rekindled that. I was like, wow, like I had never even imagined that like a kind of militant political organization like Lotta Continua in Italy in the 1970s were putting out records that were theme songs to their political campaigns. And I was like, where has this been my entire life? And it started, it launched a long process of research, which led to an exhibition that we did at Interference called If a Song Could Be Freedom, and to ultimately this mm-hmm. book project, which, you know, I've never been a musician. I was always the person who designed the record covers, not played the music. And so I still know just as little about actual music as I did then, but I've always been absolutely fascinated with the apparatus around music, how music is a tool that produces culture that mobilizes people, whether that's mobilizing 14 to 24-year-olds to sort of build their own little universe in punk or hip-hop or countercultural or ways, or like this world that has kind of opened up and seeing that people all over the world have been using music as an amazing organizing tool to actually affect pretty immense and impressive social transformation and change.
Did you ever have to wait in an emergency room for hours? That's right. And when the boss's daughter comes in, the doctor take her out of sight. So fee-fi-fo-fum, look out, bosses, here the workers come. We're gonna smash you, boss, get ready, so get ready. The workers will unite a fight, so get ready, so get ready. Here we come, get ready, boss, here we come.
Yeah, and that's amazing, because I mean, that's pretty much exactly what we're looking at on the Rebel Beat, are these linkages between social movements and music. And, you know, this is actually, it's like very apropos that we're talking about, you know, your Encyclopedia of Political Record Labels, because, you know, we were doing a small series profiling different political record labels here on the Rebel Beat a couple years back. So looking at labels like the G7 Welcoming Committee, Rebel Time Records, Firebrand Records, who we worked with here on the Rebel Beat. What's really interesting for me, actually, like looking at your encyclopedia, is I come from a similar background as you, like being that kind of like DIY anarchist punk scene, which of course is very, very political music. But I think, you know, for a lot of people in the punk scene, maybe sometimes we have blinders on to the sense, I'll just speak for myself here, but like you really think that like punk is like the be all and end all of political music. And then I think I kind of like shared your surprise in discovering like, oh wow, like, you know, look at all this like radical Italian folk music or Kurdish folk music or, you know, hip hop, like how hip hop has been such a huge mobilizing tool. And so that's like really fascinating to me. And this book is an incredible project because it really reads like an encyclopedia. It's all in alphabetical order. The information is very digestible. So yeah, how did you move kind of towards that idea of doing an encyclopedia out of it?
I mean, I think part of it comes out of a kind of built-in obsessiveness. Mm-hmm. I pretty quickly realized that although I really appreciated a lot of the music, and a lot of it was really blew my mind because it's so fundamentally difficult for me to imagine it as being politically mobilizing, because it's a sets of sounds that are just my ear is not familiar to. So if you listen to sort of like Eritrean marching songs or, you know, communist fado records from Portugal, these are not kinds of sounds that I'm used to hearing in this as being rousing. And I think I realized that I was never gonna necessarily be able to suss all of that out, but what I could do and what I was really interested in is connecting all of the kind of architecture behind the sound. Mm-hmm. And looking at not just how the music mobilized people, but how the record as a physical object is a tool that's been used in social struggle. And that led me to sort of researching the vinyl record, and sort of realizing that, you know, basically what we understand as the vinyl record, the 33 and a third RPM 12 inch and the 45 revolutions per minute 7 inch, those were both created in the late 1940s, but didn't become the dominant form of music distribution until the late 1950s. And then the vinyl record is basically dominant from, you know, 1956, 1957 up to 1990. And 1990 is the first year that the cassette and the CD overcome the vinyl record in terms of distribution and sales. And so I was looking at this and then thinking about that in relationship to politics and social movements. And it sort of clicked for me that the vinyl record as an object rises to dominance at the exact moment that the civil rights movement is coming into its own in the context of the US. And then it ends in 1990, which is the year that Nelson Mandela is released from prison. And two of the social movements that most profoundly and effectively used recorded sound were the civil rights movement and the anti-apartheid movement. So I started to think about the history of this form as tracked onto the history of the social movements in the second half of the 20th century and how they almost exactly match and map each other.
The freedom of African peoples in their continent, the struggle of freedom fighters in their aims to be recognized, the abolition of apartheid and racism in Southern Africa. I can see people die. I can see them hung up in the trees. I can see people die. Oh Lord, let them be free once again. The abolition of the undercover colonial Christianism and its destruction of African culture, religion, music, dances, herbalism, and the philosophical thought of the people to be recognized. The abolition of the degradation of African peoples, the scandalization of everything African, either within the continent or outside the continent.
Yeah, I mean, that's really fascinating too, because it's like one way to look at this is it's not exactly record labels in the traditional sense of record labels that you're writing about here, right? Like we think of a record label as like you walk in a Sony and you sign a record deal and then you go into the studio and you put your record out. But a lot of the entries you have in this encyclopedia are things like theater troupes, NGOs, or even political parties, like you're mentioning the ANC. So can you talk about why you decided to expand that notion of record labels?
I became really interested in how such an amazingly broad group of people and organizations reach to the vinyl record as a tool in their struggles. And especially at a time when it was comparatively not that easy to produce a record. Now you can put out, a set of files and distribute them on the internet almost instantaneously for almost no cost. But for a small community organization in 1971 to actually record a bunch of bands, master that recording, press a record, do all the work to create liner notes and information, design a cover, print a cover with a printer, and produce this physical object that then they distributed as part of their organizing work, that's an immense amount of effort. And so there was a lot of thought that went into this being something that was worth doing. And I found just innumerable cases where, you know, a solidarity organization in the north of England in 1984 decides to put out a record in support of the sort of great English or, you know, miners' strike in the UK in 84 and 85. And they're like, we're going to put out this record with local bands made up by local union members, miners, and we're going to sell it. And we're going to have it as, you know, we're going to make it a benefit record. And they decide, you know, we can probably sell 500 records. So they press 500 records, and then a bigger label like Rough Trade decides to distribute it. And then because of the politicization of the times, something like the New Music Express or Sounds, one of these big music magazines, does a review of it. And then within a week, they've sold out of all 500 and they have pre-orders for 1,000 more. Mm. And the how much the record as an object became something that was desirous, and it in like all of the different capacities that it could play as a tool of solidarity, that not only does it actually carry a message in its recording, so you have the songs, and those songs can be either new songs that are made up, or more often than not, and especially in relationship to labor, it's sort of reinterpretations of working class mobilizing songs, whether it's like in England, a song like The Red Flag, or a version of The Internationale, Bella Ciao, etc. So you have that valence that it works on, but then you also have the packaging, which basically becomes a piece of agitprop for the struggle. So, you know, continuing with the case of the miners' strike, there's, you know, I have a half a dozen records that you open it up and it's a gatefold sleeve and it has information, immense amounts of information about the strike. There's actually a petition that's wedged between, you know, the record and the sleeve. Wow. There's flyers for demonstrations that get stuck in. So then it has the valence of solidarity as an actual distribution of hard information. Mm-hmm. And then there's the selling of it and it becoming a tool for actually raising money and funds that go into a strike fund to directly support miners. And how, I mean, I don't want to be one of those people that just kind of like craps on everything new and sort of fetishizes the old.
You can do it a little bit. Go ahead.
But how we've lost a lot of that by music largely just becoming something that's file-based and dematerialized.
Ci son tanti compagni di cui siamo privati, perché questa giustizia li vuole carcerati, però son fianco a fianco con altri proletari che passano la vita dentro i penitenziari. Si stanno organizzando per far delle prigioni una base di lotta contro i padroni. Per questo hanno bisogno anche del...
One interesting thing that I was just thinking about is, again, reading through this, it seems like a lot of the entries in there, so especially with, you know, some of the labor unions or maybe some of the political parties in there, is that they seem like they only ever put out one record. It might have been like a one-off thing that they did because it wasn't their main focus, whereas a traditional record label, you wouldn't survive if you only put out one record. Like, you have to exist to put out record labels. And, you know, for me reading through it, it was interesting because, I was actually surprised in a good way that a label like the G7 Welcoming Committee Records, right, which is a label that I grew up on, is a label that really influenced my politicization. So that was, of course, run by Propagandhi out of Winnipeg, and they put out bands that shared their, you know, political ideology, but also they put out a lot of books. It was a book distribution as well. So they were distributing AK Press up in Canada before AK really had a big reach, I would say, up here north of the border. And so it's interesting to me that like a record label like G7, which, you know, is an explicitly political record label, was not in there, but you had some of these other smaller, or no, I don't want to say smaller organizations, but maybe smaller in the sense of their actual output of music. So can you maybe talk a little bit, like, I don't know if that specific example of G7 resonated for you in terms of why you didn't put it in and maybe how you decided to put in some and not put in others?
Absolutely. This is a debate I had with myself, and then also ultimately a debate I had with my publisher, because you know, the book is being put out by Common Notions, and which is a small kind of political publisher here in the U.S. and in Brooklyn, and they also grew up on Propaganda and the Weaker Thens, and they're like, "Where's the G7 Welcoming Committee?" basically, I needed to set limits. Or I felt like I wanted and needed to set limits. And I knew that I was really interested in, the vinyl record. And so I set time boundaries, 1960 to 1995. Because I feel like although vinyl records after 1995 were immensely mobilizing in a subcultural context, in a larger way of looking at politics and movements, they're ultimately, it's sort of nostalgic, mm-hmm. Because it no longer was the way that most people were listening to music. And so if you really wanted to reach people politically with sound after 1995, your go-to solution would not be a vinyl record.
Right.
And which is not to throw shade on G7 at all, but they put their first record out in 1996. And so it fell out of the purview of what I felt like I was trying to really look at. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that makes sense.
It's the same with like Constellation and Godspeed. It all is just after my cutoff point. otherwise, it would have been included. Although from the beginning, I did want punk and rock music to from the get-go to be a minority within the project. Because I think it's actually a minority in how music has been used politically. And it's the easiest for us to access. And so I wanted to try to give people access to things that they would have never thought of or seen otherwise.
For sure. Yeah. And you can see so much of that in there, like, you know, all different genres coming from different continents. Can you tell us, yeah, maybe what are a couple other examples of record labels in there that really stood out for you as being fascinating to research and also to listen to?
Well, I think that maybe a couple examples that are interesting because they blur some of the lines between what is a label and what is a political organization. You know, in Chile, there was a label called DICAP, which basically is an acronym for, you know, Popular Discs from the Americas, that spells out DICAP. And DICAP developed in the late 1960s and early 1970s out of a smaller label that was called Jota Jota. And Jota Jota came from... the word Jota was a slang for the young communists. And so this is actually a party label of the Young Communist Party of Chile, that their first record was a record by Quilapayún, which is a big Chilean political folk group, or Nueva Canción, new song group, that put out an album called Vietnam, which is a solidarity record with the people of Vietnam and in the late 1960s. That evolved into DICAP, and DICAP, at its peak in 1973, had they were putting out records by people like Victor Jara, Inti Illimani, the Paras, Angel Para, Isabella Para, Violeta Para, their mom, psychedelic rock bands like Blops. They dominated the Chilean record market, and almost all of the records that they put out were explicitly political. And most of these bands were ideologically communist or socialist, very consciously, explicitly, and outspokenly wrote songs for and performed songs for the people, were involved in a very deep and profound level in getting Salvador Allende and the Popular Unity Party elected in Chile. And then in 1973, when the fascist coup happens, they basically have to very quickly close up shop and flee the country. Wow. Pinochet's police go into the DICAP office and smash everything up, destroy all the master tapes that they can find. And then the DICAP office moves to a sort of evolving series of countries across Europe. And then they, as a tool for the opposition to Pinochet and the dictatorship in Chile, they begin licensing those immensely popular records to dozens of labels all over the world. So rather than just sort of centralizing themselves like a traditional record label would, they decide we're going to actually have sort of auxiliary labels in France, Spain, Italy, Scandinavia, other Latin American countries, the US and Canada, that are going to help us get this music out in as far and wide as possible. And it's a pretty amazing story of music not just being like a tactic or one tool in a large toolbox of opposition, but like becoming in a way in the Chilean context, one of the dominant strategies for opposing, building support in opposition to the dictatorship. Is by a stroke of luck, most of the bands, Cuida Payan, Inti Illimani, the Paras, were all out of the country at the time. And so they basically turned their entire careers into being the voice of the opposition movement. And then the label turned itself into basically a distribution technique for getting the music out as far and wide as possible and encouraging people all over the world to continually support and put out and play and distribute this music in opposition to the dictatorship.
El derecho de vivir, poeta Ho Chi Minh, que golpea de Vietnam a toda la humanidad, ningún cañón borrará el surco de tu arrozal. El derecho de vivir en paz. Indochina es el lugar más allá del ancho mar, donde revientan la flor con genocidio y napalm. La luna es una explosión que funde todo el clamor. El derecho de vivir en paz.
Yeah. And another label that I was really pleased to find in there was the Comité Québec Chile, which, you know, of course, me living in Quebec, I just kind of gravitated towards that. And one thing that was actually really cool seeing that in there is a couple years ago now, I was just like digging through a crate in a local record shop and pulled out this music. It was all like political music from Chile put out by that record label. And, you know, of course, like I flip it over and I look on the back and it costs like $2 or $3 because it was in like the used bin at a record store, just like totally hidden. But I, like yourself, I just kind of gravitate toward any music that's political. So I bought it, brought it home. And what's fascinating about that record is you have some political songs. I think there's like some tunes from Victor Jara on there. But then you also have speeches from Salvador Allende on it. So it's like, it really is this interesting mixture of agitprop where it's like you've got the spoken word, you've got the music. I imagine at one point maybe the record came with liner notes, but unfortunately there are no liner notes still in it. But is that record label, Comité Québec Chile, would that have been involved with this kind of international branch of DICAP?
Absolutely. Like they would have licensed all of that music. Although, I mean, I don't know. I know that they put out a record by, there was a group of very, very young musicians who were in university when the coup happened, and they formed a band called Caraxu. Who I know that, and they were I mean, this is getting into like a lot of political minutia, but they were huge supporters of the MIR, which was like the armed Marxist organization that went underground when the coup happened and fought a sort of unfortunately kind of ineffectual armed struggle against the Pinochet regime. I know that the Kimite, one of the records that they put out was a Karaksu LP. They weren't officially part of DICAP, but they played regularly with musicians who had performed in these other DICAP bands. And so it, after the coup, I'm sure there were internal struggles, but there was, at least on the surface, a pretty profound popular front in opposition. Mm-hmm. So I suspect that the DICAP people would have been involved in that in some way.
Puisque la provocation, celle qu'on n'a pas dénoncée, ce fut de nous envoyer en réponse à nos questions vos hommes bien lunettés, bien casqués, bien boucliers, bien grenadés, bien soldés, nous nous sommes mis à crier. Parce que vous avez posté dans les cafés, dans les gares, des hommes aux allures bizarres pour ficher, pour arrêter les Krivine, les Joshua, au nom de je ne sais quelle loi, et beaucoup d'autres encore, nous avons crié plus fort.
Well, it's an amazing project to kind of compile all of this information, all this research. So I'm really excited about the book. I'm really excited for a lot of our listeners to check it out. I want to flash forward, though, to today, just to kind of get maybe some of your reflections looking at, you know, this body of research that you've done and, you know, looking at how music kind of intertwines with social movements these days. Now, for one thing, of course, record labels aren't as relevant as they used to be. I mean, these days it's kind of like anyone can put out a song on the internet and it can go viral. But yeah, like, you know, clearly these organizations and these labels aren't being used in the same way today as they were in the period that you're looking at in your book from the 60s to the 90s. But do you see like resonances or legacies of that work in social movement music that you see today?
I think that there definitely are, but I don't think that, at least in the context of North America, we've quite figured out how to recapture music as a kind of like soul of a movement. It's hard to imagine the civil rights movement without song. And I don't think that that's true for most of the movements today. I think that music is underutilized, and then for better or for worse, it's very quickly capitalized on by very successful recording artists, which I think is a dual-edged sword. Of course, it's a huge boost to your movement when an amazingly successful artist is performing something that is in theory in support of you. But in the long run, it seems to be that they tend to get more out of it than the movement does. Mm-hmm. So it's tricky. I feel like it echoes a lot that has happened where, in theory, we have more access and control to the means of production than ever before. But because we have basically abandoned a distribution system that that has any real accountability within it, we can make things, but then our best bet is to throw them out in the world and hope that they get found. As opposed to in the past when we had like fully integrated systems of being able to produce a record and had sympathetic distributors that had sympathetic record stores, where there was a whole system in place to reach an audience that you had some sense of relationship or accountability to. And now I feel like we've lost some of that. And it's also, it's really hard to bring an MP3 to a demonstration and distribute it.
Definitely. And I think like one of the things too that could be changing is just the way that music is consumed now, right? Like on mobile devices where people are listening, you know, like a lot like through headphones. And so there just seems to be less of a communal vibe around media in general. Although who knows, like that could change. I mean, one thing that I'm loving seeing these days, especially on my visits down to New York, is like young people riding around the city with like Bluetooth speakers hanging off their bike and just like blasting music again, like people did out of their cars, but now people can do it on bikes with like pretty inexpensive technology. So that's cool to see.
Absolutely.
So we're speaking with Josh McPhee again about his upcoming book, An Encyclopedia of Political Record Labels. Josh, just before we go, one kind of funny thing that I loved reading in the introduction to this book is that you were playing a lot of the music that you're researching to your toddler to kind of see what he gravitates to, or to see what his jams are. So what does he enjoy through all of this?
I mean, he is evolving very quickly, but he absolutely loved reggae.
Who wouldn't?
it's funny because I don't know, I wrote a little bit about this in the introduction as well, which is that like growing up in a like extremely sort of comprehensive or almost totalizing punk scene, it was at the same time very austere. It was like real kind of purity where you just only listened to punk music. And so when I grew up, I knew nothing about reggae. And so part of what's been really fun is to introduce this stuff to him when he's so young. He's really into reggae. He loves Fela and a lot of like High Life and Afrobeat stuff. There's a one side of one particular Victor Jara record that, like, when he was really young, it would not fail that if I put it on, he would stop what he was doing and just sit quietly and listen.
Wow.
So there's a lot of different stuff that I've done. I've played for him, and you know, some of it he's into and some of it he just, you know, could care less. Generally, I think it got to the point where he actually became obsessed with the record player.
Oh, yeah.
And so it became about him getting to touch the buttons and getting to like move the arm and him trying to figure out how it worked. That became even more interesting and exciting to him than the music itself.
Yeah, I can imagine.
So maybe he has a little bit of me in him.
Yeah.
Where he's like interested in the structure around the music as much as the sound.
Well, I mean, how could that not be fascinating for a kid, right? Where it's like their generation is going to look at music as something you just click on a computer, but to actually see that in its physical form, like the record spinning at 33.3 RPM, it's a beautiful thing. So,
and get to like speed it up and slow it down.
It sounds like he's got a good taste in music though.
Yeah. Well, we're going to try.
So once again, we've been speaking with Josh McPhee about the upcoming book, An Encyclopedia of Political Record Labels. Can you just tell us like, when is the book scheduled for release and how will people be able to find it?
Absolutely. The publisher again is Common Notions, and it's set for release in October, although you'll start to see it filtering out before then. We'll be getting books back in time to send out for review and such. So and then you'll be able to get it hopefully anywhere where you get books. It's distributed through AK Press. Of course, but then also it will be on all of the other bigger kind of corporate places if you feel the need. And then we're working really hard to try to get record stores to stock the book.
Oh, awesome.
So we've got a huge list of hundreds of record stores in North America that we've been sending out postcards and emails to try to get encourage them to order the book and stock it, because I really think that there's a huge audience for this, not just from people who are interested in politics. I mean, Common Notions is a political press, but people who are just kind of obsessed with music, because there's just so much interesting tidbits in here about the culture around music. Mm-hmm. That are not the stories that normally get told.
For sure. And I really hope that people will be able to pick it up in record shops, because like, what better of a place to discover this lineage and this history than in a record shop? So,
yeah. And then, you know, hopefully then the project that this is going to spawn is in collecting all of the records to do this project. I now have this like massive collection of amazing visual culture around music. Mm-hmm. And so my goal next, hopefully, is to put out one of these nice big books that documents all of the record covers and the visual culture from political music.
Oh yeah, that'd be amazing. Well, once again, we've been speaking with Josh McPhee. You can check out his work with Just Seeds at justseeds.org. You can check out his other books on AK Press, and do check out the Encyclopedia of Political Record Labels when it drops. Josh, thanks so much for joining us on The Rebel Beat today.
Thanks so much, Aaron.
All right, welcome back here on the Rebel Beat podcast. Once again, hope you enjoyed our interview with Josh McPhee. And if you want to order your copy of An Encyclopedia of Political Record Labels, a really, really beautiful book to have in your hands, you can head on over to the publisher's website at commonnotions.org. So it's time right now, as we do each and every time we're rounding down this podcast, to do our Turn It Up segment. That's where we look at a musician or an artist or an activist who are using their platform to push for radical change. And on today's show, we want to look at an amazing Egyptian singer, Rami Assam. So first of all, we've been kind of doing a little bit of coverage around Egyptian dissident music on the Rebel Beat the last few weeks. If you missed our last episode, episode 94 with Weka Suleiman, I want you to go back and check that one out, because that was a lot of fun. And again, you can find that on our website at rebelbeatradio.com. But today we want to look at Rami Assam. And Rami was basically the singer of the Egyptian Revolution, that incredible movement in Tahrir Square that kicked off in early 2011 and then eventually led to the ousting of Egyptian dictator Hosni Mubarak. And so Rami became famous for playing these shows in front of millions of people gathered in Tahrir. He would take the chants that people were doing against the Egyptian regime and just literally turn those chants into song. And Rami, like many other artists in Egypt, sadly has come under threat from the Egyptian regime, because they know that his music and what he stands for are such a threat to the powers that be. Sadly, Rami had to flee his homeland in Egypt and resettle in Sweden a few years ago. So that's where he's been living in exile ever since. But he continues to be very active in pushing for social change in Egypt and also pushing for the freedom of his countrymen. And so one really scary thing that's happened is a lot of artists who have collaborated with Rami over the last few years have come under the boot of the Egyptian state and have wound up in jail. One of those is a poet named Galal al-Baheri, who actually wrote the lyrics to one of Rami Assam's songs. It was a song called Balaha that he put out in 2018, and a song that directly went after the current president of Egypt, Sisi. And so I'm just going to read you a short little statement on Rami Assam's website calling for Galal's freedom. So it says, in February 2018, Egyptian artist Rami Assam released a song and music video, Balaha. Lyricist of the song, poet Galal al-Baheri, director of the music video, Shadi Habash, as well as Rami's former social media expert, Mustafa Gamal, have been arrested in Egypt since. On the 31st of July, 2018, Galal al-Baheri was sentenced to 3 years in prison and a hefty fine in the military court in Cairo because of his unreleased book of poetry, The Finest Women on Earth. Galal is also facing charges in a civilian court case concerning Balaha, which he has been conditionally released from. However, he will stay in prison, having been sentenced already in the military court. And so this is, again, a really frightening thing that's happening to artists and especially to dissident artists in Egypt. If you want to find ways to support, if you want to check out that tune Balaha by Rami Assam, there's petitions, there's all sorts of calls to action on Rami's website. We'll put a link again to that in the show notes, but it's Rami Assam Music and it's /Balaha to find all the information on that case. So that about wraps it up for this week's show. Thank you for listening. Especially thank you to all our supporters on Patreon, Matt, Nagesh, Donald, Sarah, Ryan, Misha, Ross, DJ Kill McKinley, Nick, Philip, Sasha, Lee, Jean-Philippe, Grill, Sarah, Rose, Justine, Yannick, Andy, Frank, Anne, and Andrew. If you want to hear your name amidst that list of wonderful supporters, you can head on over to our Patreon page. That's patreon.com/rebelbeatradio. Keep supporting independent podcasts. Keep listening. Hopefully we'll be back in not too long with a new episode. We're out of here. Stay rebel. طولت علينا بطلتك زهقنا خلاص من خلقتك دقلاه ينور صلعتك ويسيبك حظك من الدعاء وتلم في ايدك شلتك وتنور سجن المزرعة ايه يا بلحة ايه يا بلحة 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 4 سنين عدوا كده والشعب مش لاقي الا ضب مدت